Today, we're taking a deep dive into the Book of Lamentations. Imagine a city, you know, once bustling, full of life, now just sitting solitary.
Like a widow, the text says.
Exactly, weeping through the night, its former friends, now enemies, people scattered, no rest anywhere. This isn't just like a historical record.
No, no.
It's this raw, poetic outpouring of just profound grief. You brought us this ancient text, and it really gives voice to unimaginable sorrow.
It really does. And our mission today is to, well, truly unpack this remarkable document.
Okay.
It's far more than just a collection of verses. It's a visceral expression of collective trauma and also a challenging search for meaning when facing utter devastation.
So we'll explore the depth of the lament itself.
Yeah, the reasons it gives for that sorrow, which can be difficult. And then, maybe surprisingly, those glimmers of hope you find within it.
Let's begin with the opening imagery then, because it really pulls you in immediately. It paints this incredibly vivid picture of Jerusalem.
Personified as a grieving woman.
Right, asking, how doth the city sit solitary? That was full of people. How has she become as a widow? I mean, it's such a powerful reversal of fortune.
Yeah.
This once great capital, now tributary, paying tribute.
And what's so impactful here is the language, how it uses these deeply emotional, almost personal terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she weepeth sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. And among all her lovers, quote unquote, she have none to comfort her.
All her friends turned treacherous, became enemies.
Exactly. So this isn't just physical collapse we're talking about. It's this profound sense of betrayal, isolation.
Yeah, deep isolation.
We hear about Judah gone into captivity because of affliction, dwelling among the heathen, finding no rest. The text really wants us to feel that abandonment.
And the devastation isn't just the people. It seems to extend to every facet of life, even faith.
Oh, absolutely.
The ways of Zion do mourn because none come to the solemn feasts. All her gates desolate, priests sighing.
Her virgins afflicted. She is in bitterness. It lists it all.
Even the city's beauty, it says, is departed. And her princes are like deer with no pasture.
Hearts that find no pasture, yeah.
Yeah.
Gone without strength before the pursuer. It's total societal breakdown.
And spiritual breakdown, too.
And it's not just defeat. There's this element of public shaming. Her adversaries prosper, and they actually mock at her Sabbaths.
Wow.
The text really emphasizes that the very people who once honored her now despise her. Why? Because they have seen her nakedness.
So it's a complete humiliation.
Yeah.
Every aspect of identity, dignity, just stripped away.
Utterly.
Okay, so after painting this truly devastating picture of Jerusalem suffering, the text then starts to grapple with that uncomfortable question, why?
Right.
Why did this happen? And it doesn't really shy away from attributing blame, does it? It states, her adversaries are the chief, her enemies prosper, for the Lord hath afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions.
That's right. And this idea, this attribution of suffering to divine judgment.
Yeah.
Well, it was pretty foundational to their worldview back then. Seeing a nation's catastrophe as a direct consequence of its actions against God's will. For these ancient communities, it wasn't just about blame. It actually served a purpose.
Which was?
It provided a framework, you know.
Yeah.
A way to understand the chaos and maybe find a path towards repentance, towards reconciliation.
Okay, so the lament isn't just a cry of pain.
No, it's also a confession. It explicitly acknowledges the Lord is righteous, for I have rebelled against his commandment.
The imagery used for divine action is, well, it's incredibly powerful, but often unsettling too.
Very much so.
The text describes the Lord as an active participant in the suffering, almost like a cosmic aggressor, you know?
Mm.
From above hath he sent fire into my bones, or he hath spread a net for my feet.
Yeah, and even more jarring, perhaps. The Lord hath trodden underfoot all my mighty men.
Crushing the young men like grapes in a wine press.
He hath called an assembly against me to crush my young men,
mm.
as in a wine press. It's direct. It's graphic.
It really is.
And what's striking is this consistent portrayal of the divine as, well, both the author of the suffering and a righteous judge.
A paradox, almost.
In a way. The Lord hath swallowed up all the habitations of Jacob, and hath not pitied. Thrown down strongholds, polluted the kingdom.
Burned like a flaming fire.
Burned against Jacob like a flaming fire, yes, and bent his bow like an enemy. It suggests this belief that the devastation wasn't just random bad luck.
But a direct consequence.
A direct consequence of disobedience, of divine will, and it even extends blame internally.
How so?
Pointing to the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests. as contributing factors to the tragedy.
So this theological framework, it offered them a way to process something unfathomable.
Exactly. Even if it meant confronting their own perceived failings head on.
Beyond the reasons why, though, what really, really resonates for me in this text, what hits home, is the sheer, raw human experience of it all.
Oh, absolutely.
That universal cry, "Is it nothing to you, all ye that pass by? Behold and see if there be any sorrow, like unto my sorrow." It's almost an accusation, isn't it?
It is, a direct appeal for empathy.
Yeah.
Like, look at this. Don't ignore this pain.
Yeah.
And the text doesn't hold back on the chilling details, particularly the famine and its horrific consequences.
It's hard to read.
It is. People who sigh, they seek bread, they have given their pleasant things for meat to relieve the soul. Can you imagine trading treasures just for food?
And the children.
Oh, the children. Children and the sucklings swoon in the streets of the city, crying, "Where is corn and wine?"
Just heartbreaking.
The tongue of the sucking child cleaveth to the roof of his mouth for thirst. And then, well, then the most horrifying detail.
The cannibalism.
Yeah. The hands of the pitiful women have soddened their own children. They were their meat in the destruction of the daughter of my people. This isn't just desperation anymore.
Whoa.
It's the total collapse of humanity itself.
And the suffering, it goes beyond just hunger, too. The text mentions other things.
Yes. Our skin was black like an oven because of the terrible famine. So the physical toll.
And then graphic violence, degradation.
Right. They ravished the women in Zion and the maids in the cities of Judah, princes being hanged, elders dishonored.
And the forced labor. They took the young men to grind and the children fell under the wood. Yeah. It's just, it paints this picture of complete physical and psychological collapse.
It does. And the extent of their suffering is presented as so profound, so extreme, that the text actually compares it to Sodom.
Saying Zion's punishment is worse?
Greater than the punishment of the sin of Sodom, yes. And even those who were once, you know, pure and consecrated, like the Nazarites.
Individuals dedicated by religious vows.
Exactly. Even they are now unrecognizable. Their visage is blacker than a coal. Their skin cleaveth to their bones. It is withered. It had become like a stick.
Just wasted away.
Completely. And then the joy of our heart has ceased. Our dance is turned into mourning. The crown has fallen from our head.
It's the death of their collective spirit.
Precisely. It's not just physical destruction. It gets to a point where death by the sword is seen as preferable to the slow agony of starvation.
Mm.
It just underscores how deeply trauma can strip away everything, identity, celebration, life itself.
But then after all this, after such an unrelenting depiction of despair, something remarkable happens. There's a shift.
A definite shift.
The speaker, who identifies himself as the man that hath seen affliction by the rod of his wrath, acknowledges all his suffering, but then declares, "This I recall to my mind, therefore have I hope."
Mm-hmm.
It feels like such a surprising turn, a really deeply human moment of resilience.
And this shift is absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
Because it roots the hope not in, like, wishful thinking.
Right.
But in a specific belief about the divine character itself.
Okay, how so?
The text says, "It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. And then they are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness."
New every morning?
Yeah, that conviction that the Lord is good unto them that wait for him, it offers a path forward, a belief that the Lord will not cast off forever.
So even though God caused the grief.
Though he caused grief, yet will he have compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. So it's not just, you know, abstract theological hope. It's this profound statement about the daily renewal of mercy.
Suggesting that even in the darkest night, a new dawn brings fresh possibilities for compassion.
That seems to be the idea, yes.
There's also this very active call within the text for introspection, isn't there? For turning back.
Yes, definitely.
"Wherefore doth a living man complain, a man for the punishment of his sins? Let us search and try our ways and turn again to the Lord."
So it suggests that human agency, changing human behavior, is seen as part of that path to restoration.
A necessary response to the judgment they believe they face.
Exactly. And this creates a really fascinating tension within the text itself.
How do you mean?
Well, it's acknowledging sin and suffering, right? But at the same time, simultaneously, it's pleading for justice and restoration.
Ah, holding both together.
Right. There's this powerful prayer for divine intervention against their enemies. "Render unto them a recompense, O Lord, according to the work of their hands." A call for justice.
But also
this fervent, deeply personal plea for the community's own renewal. "Turn thou us unto thee, O Lord, and we shall be turned. Renew our days as of old.
Renew our days as of old. That's powerful.
It really is. It's a testament to this enduring faith.
Yeah.
Even while acknowledging their desperate state, you know, thou hast utterly rejected us. Thou art very wroth against us.
Yet still asking for transformation.
Still actively pleading for transformation.
Yeah.
It highlights that even in profound brokenness, the human spirit just yearns for return, for renewal.
So bringing this all together then, what does this deep dive into the Book of Lamentations really mean for us? It's been, well, quite a journey.
It has.
Through sorrow, self-reflection, and this persistent, sometimes fragile-seeming hope in the face of just unimaginable loss.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture,
mm-hmm.
I think it really highlights how ancient communities grappled with immense suffering. They didn't just, you know, passively endure it.
Right.
They actively sought to attribute meaning to it, to articulate their grief in these powerful ways, and crucially, to hold on to a vision of restoration, even when it seemed impossible.
It's a powerful reminder, isn't it, of the human capacity to confront despair head on.
Yes, and to still articulate that yearning for mercy, for justice.
The resilience found within these ancient words, it's truly remarkable, the ability to lament so fully, so honestly, yet still reach for hope.
It really is. It's a testament to that enduring human search for meaning, even when everything seems utterly lost.
Yeah.
And perhaps it leaves us, and you listening, to ponder this. How do societies, how do individuals process overwhelming collective trauma today? And what role might self-reflection and that persistent search for meaning play in finding a path toward renewal, even when that renewal seems utterly, completely impossible?